Accession number 16755, Reel 6.
Colonel Strangeways, Reel 6. I think you were saying that you cut your staff and that the camouflage experts went to the war cabin in an attempt to have their numbers restored.
Yes. If you start hurting someone's empire, you expect this to happen. And understand it. They'd all been trained, and they'd all been sort of led to believe they're going to do this, that, and the other. But in the end, you've got to, if you're in command of something, because I was of that, you've got to do what you think is the right way of doing it. Otherwise, you're lost. It's not a committee. And I had excellent people left behind who were very loyal and worked extremely hard. There was a man whose name I forget, Sir John something. He had run brilliantly the decoy fires and things to divert the enemy aircraft when they were bombing England. And he trained, or had trained, a lot of pioneers, etc., to do the job. I was going to have dummy bridges and things in the bridgehead. Sir John Turner, that's his name. And he assumed that his pioneers would go over. And I said, no. My own engineers, I mean real engineers, will go over, not pioneer engineers. And I was invited to go and see, I forget the name of the head airman, and Sir John, have lunch with them at the RAF headquarters. I did. After lunch, I had to say, I'm very sorry, but this is not going to be. I told them why. They were pioneers. They'd not been ever been in battle. They'd been bombed often enough, but they'd never been in battle, and it wasn't fair on them. They weren't of the right stuff. So I went back to President Gangle, Montes Chivas staff, and I said, told him what had happened. I said, for goodness sake, we cannot take these people over. And he said to me, David, will you compromise? So I said, yes, if it's essential, but I'm not handing this job over to anybody else except my own troops. He said, all right, leave it to me. So he got on to Cunningham, I think was his name, I'm not certain, the airman. And he agreed to accept token number, I think it was 3 or 4, in each party.
Were these pioneers you mentioned, were they from RAF construction squadrons?
They were real old, what we used to call, there was a pioneer corps in the war, and they were old people, not as old as I am, but old people, who were ex-soldiers, ex-somethings, but could do
Basic labouring,
and were jolly good people, but nothing wrong with them, but they were just a bit ancient. And so the poor chaps were put in with my little parties who were going to go over. And they went over in D+2 too. And they were terrified. They hadn't joined up for this kind of thing. But my sappers were decent sappers, and they looked after them, and they became part of the team. I was proud to be there in the end. But they could never have done it as by themselves. I mean, they wouldn't know how to do it or what to do.
Why was the RAF involved in this? Why
because the because Sir John Turner's department was under the RAF. See, it was anti-bombing, air side. And it was a matter of pride, or well, I can see the chap had built up this very, very fine organisation, and he'd been thinking in terms of them all going overseas, you see, for the battle. You could.
But presumably, his organisation had its day because the Germans weren't making manned bomber raids.
No, they weren't getting it at all. In England then. I think that was probably what was wrong. His empire was falling apart.
It needed a role.
And
where did you get your men from for our force, and how were they selected?
They had been selected.
Already?
Yes. There were three departments of it. There was the sappers, the signal unit, which was very good, and the scout car unit, which was the sonic unit. They had to diversify far more than they expected, but had a very good lieutenant colonel signals with his signal units, and he was very good. I used to have one principal, as I said, my poor unfortunate head signaler, that he would do so and so, or else. And he used to say, "Are you sure you mean that?" I said, "Absolutely. You either get through and do get the communications I demand, or you go." And he had a sense of humour. He said, "I think I know what you're saying. I can do what I like that'll achieve what you want." I said, "Exactly." Because they had lots of regulations about the length of wire they could put up, that this, that and the other, oh, goodness knows what. Well, there we are, it paid, because we was one time were the only people who could communicate back to headquarters.
You're talking here about your command signals, not your force dissemination.
Ah, yes, no, it comes out of the same unit. Oh. But you see, the command net was simple.
Presumably,
we didn't talk to one another about IR unless we could possibly help it.
How did you communicate then? By dispatch rider?
Oh, personal go visit? Myself probably, and brief them. Well, they got the pitch when you told the commanding officer what you wanted done. You explained it to the officers generally. You left them alone. They knew what to do. The more you can leave people alone, the better they probably will get on. Provide you're there to watch what's going on, and they know you're there to watch what's going on. It's healthy to have a commander that comes round and doesn't mess you up, but if they know you're coming round, that's fine. But you must never sneak up on them, that's wrong. The only people I sneaked up on were the people running the dummy landing craft. And I did a recce, a visual one, and I was suspicious. Things weren't going properly. So I came back a few days later, and I had a dummy alert. And it was chaos. They hadn't a clue what to do. There were half of them were not even up. And I was able to go right to town on them. And there was no more trouble after that. Nobody had been to see them. Nobody had been looking after them.
Who had your predecessor been then? What happened?
There had been no predecessor at all, you see.
They hadn't been ahead of the organisation.
No. There was nothing at all.
So an organisation had been set up. But
no, there was no organisation at all.
Plan.
There was just the plans. There was written plan from Schaeff, whatever they called it. you know what they did call it in those days?
Safe, yes.
Safe, was it? There was no command system. Somebody had been given the chance of making these dummy craft, and somebody had been given the job of putting some troops on board. But that was that. No, it's no good, that. They've got to feel they belong to something which is worthwhile belonging to, and doing a job which is worthwhile. And no troop, no young officer will ever think of things worthwhile unless somebody above him is interested in what he's doing. Then it becomes worthwhile. Well, he just, in those curious days before that D-Day, just sits in a puddle somewhere.
How did you recruit Dr. Olver to your headquarters?
Being on Monty's headquarters, I was one in the dragnet of people going and having medical examination, which is quite correct. I went in front of Rob. And he opened up to me that he was browned off with doing this job. And I talked to him whilst I theoretically was being examined. And I went back to the headquarters and I said, I want a doctor called Dr. Rob Oliver. Immediately he was with me. If I said, I want so-and-so, it was done.
And who are you dealing with for that? Was that with the big...
Military secretary.
Military secretary. And did you attend Montgomery's conferences in the same way as you'd attended Alexander's conferences in the Mediterranean?
Not once the battle started, because I'd go and drop in on his quarters and tell him something. He stayed away from the 21 Armed Group. He was never ever in his headquarters, or in the headquarters. General Gangwon did that. But if I, which I did, which I won't say what, needed to tell him something, or felt I should tell him something, I would go to his little camp, ask to speak to him. He never said no. I'd go in, say what I had to say. He'd say, yes, finish. I never asked, I never said. I never told anybody what I'd said or what I'd done or what I'd been. That was between him and me. And Monty was perfectly capable of looking after himself. But if you went and told him something, he trusted me. He'd known me for some time, of course. He trusted what I said. And I'd asked him to do things or suggested he did things which were pretty had a lot of effect. And when he said yes, it was yes, finish. But he knew that I would never, ever reveal what I'd done.
What sort of things were you asking him to do? Go and show himself in certain places?
No. No. But I had a very privileged position of knowing what was going on, what was happening, and what was dangerous. And some things were dangerous, and they needed correcting. Marty used to have a bunch of liaison officers. There was a shootout around the brigades and things, and bringing back information of what was going on and how things were. Well, that's all right, but they were young officers and they did a lot of good for him. But there are some things which see, Frederick de Gangon couldn't go round. He was absolutely pinned to his headquarters.
Well, someone had to mind the shop.
Yeah. And he was a wonderful man.
How did you get on with the Americans? Did you have anything to do with Bradley and his headquarters?
I did indeed. Well, I got on with them. I think, considering everything, very well. They messed me up a bit during the Battle of the Bulge.
How did they do that?
Well, they started arresting all my officers. They were spies. They were spies.
On the supposition that they were Germans in disguise.
They were Germans in disguise. I'd been given a front. Namur, Givet and Dinan was my front. And I had command of anything there, plus my own force. Were reinforced by tanks and guns. And I shot off my own officers, who obviously weren't doing any deception at all, but they were all highly trained, to various places to brief what was going to happen, what was coming in, etc. And I got no reaction from any of them. These city clots had arrested them all. Instead of ringing up and saying, oh, you know, or getting onto the blurred headquarters and saying, what's the form? No. They all had their identity cards. They all had their... Everything was normal and natural with them. Oh, we got them released very quickly.
What were you actually supposed to be doing on this front between Namur and Givet and
Dinan? I was holding it.
You were supposed to be holding it?
Yes.
And what did you actually have under your command?
Well, I had my own force, which was about 2,000-odd. I was given, again, I put in an application. I wanted some tanks, I wanted gunners, and I wanted artillery. And I got them. They came under command, or in support, the gunner would say. Very important to say that. And what used to be.
Still is.
And it's quite right, too. And if they are really in support, then they're jolly good. What are mess gunners about? And we held... I was also... had to prepare all the bridges for demolition, but not to blow anybody up. And in about 4 or 5 days, I suppose, Horrocks, the Pursuit Corps commander, as he called himself, came to go from me.
Did you have any contact with the enemy? Did the Germans approach your...
No. We were very lucky. All I did was to hand over listen to the commander's orders go back like lightning to the headquarters, explain what Horrocks was going to do, and leave it to the principal ops officer to deal with it.
Did you have any role in the final act in the Rhine crossing operations?
Oh, yes. I did a decoy thing for that. It was quite a big one, in point of fact. But I was into action of another kind immediately after the battle was over. I was given the job of running the Ruhr intelligence office responsible for denazification, all press, everything you can think of, customs control, everything. I had 100 debts sent to me. They were very good ones too. And I had a mess. I had a lovely headquarters, a place called Iserlohn. And I ran that for some time before returning to England. That's where Peter de Heaven and I kept going. He got a pack of hounds out. And we worked jolly hard, but we also played jolly hard. And I got riding again. You had to mix the two together. The war was over then.
When you did the decoy operation for the Rhine crossings, what story were you trying to?
Well, I was trying to move them from where they were going to actually attack, and I had dummy parachutes, I had sonic warfare, I had a whole lot. It was a bit of a party really, because there was nothing really going on, but it had to be done.
So this is trying to mislead them, draw them away from Mont Valiant, from the area of.
I can't remember where it was. I know I think it was further south.
Further south?
I think it was further south. That was it. I watched the operation when the gliders came and things. It was a.
So gliders had some very heavy losses, didn't they?
They did.
Caught.
But it. I'm afraid it was the UK planning that went wrong, as I think it did.
Did you have anything to do with Operation Market Garden?
Now, which one was that?
Arnhem.
Yes. I can't remember what I did.
One thing that was going on at that time was that there were two bridgeheads. One was at Geel. On the road up towards Breda and then Bosch through Tilburg, and the other was at Neerpelt, and Montgomery made his main thrust up through the Neerpelt bridge up to Eindhoven, Nijmegen, Arnhem, that direction. Was there any attempt that you know of to mislead the Germans into thinking that that was a distraction and that the main attack would be up through Geel and the central route?
I honestly can't remember, but I can assure you that if it was as you say, I would have been involved with doing something. But I can't bring it to mind. But that'll be in the war diaries. There was an official history of our force. And it is, I suppose.
Was this a 21 Army Group official history?
No, it was written myself and one of my officers called Philip Curtis. He did wrote most of it. I edited it. I brought him back to England with our papers to do the job. He's still very much with us. Bless his heart. Of course, the old boy met again. I'd known him since he was that high. And he was a Cambridge boy.
What happened to the official history? Did it go into the?
Well, it would have gone to the War Office.
The War Office. Mm-hmm. So it would be probably in the archives of Army Historical Branch.
It wouldn't be in the Historical Branch, I wouldn't have thought. Maybe in the War Office. I don't know what they do. You see. When I left the army, which was sometime rather, I went to the church. And from the day that I did that, I cut entirely from the army. In fact, very few people knew I'd been in the army. I had to completely cut, throw everything out of my mind and switch to something else, which I'm very glad I did. It's only people like you, and the Americans and so on, who brought me back on this course. And then the D-Day thing. And I was doing a recording for some firm or other in Suttock Park. Where the old war thing is. And when I'd finished, the mess, whatever they call it in the Navy, came up and said the station commander would very much like to see me. So I said, with pleasure. And he came in and he said, would you come here? Wasn't it a day when the Queen was going there to brief Her Majesty? So I said, why me? She said, you're the only one left who was at that final meeting. Well, I was at the final meeting. That's when the decision was made to go. I was on everything, you see. And the moment I got they were going, I had to go off and press my buttons. At night. Well, I went. And it was crazy, really, because the Prime Minister was down that day and it was a most extraordinary affair, pouring with rain. I went to the dinner that night, which was tremendous. And Her Majesty was as you expect her to be. I regret to say that the President of the United States of America, we thought, was absolutely terrible. But I was amongst all sorts of people. And it was a very splendid occasion. But all these things have been recorded, but not all recorded, and never will be, as far as I'm concerned. So what I've told you is just an outline of what the deception plan or plans were and how they were achieved. And I would say this, that the economy in staff is a very fundamental principle. And the fewer people you have, the better. The harder they work, the more responsibility they get, the greater will be your success.